I happened to see a DevOps talk a month ago, which was titled Unit Test Your Java Architecture. And I found that to be super interesting because unit testing is something that I've always attributed to code and something more objective, like, okay, is the code working fine or not? And architecture has always been a little more subjective in my mind. It is a little more soft and a little less concrete. So the idea of unit testing architecture I found to be very intriguing. So I listened to this talk by Roland Weissleder. Did I get that right?
Yeah,
All
perfect.
right, awesome. So this was about a framework called ArcUnit. I wasn't familiar with that, so I found this talk to be really interesting. I will paste a link to this talk in this description so that he can check it out. And I reached out to Roland and asked him if he'd be, interested in sharing some of his experiences with ArcUnit to us. And Roland was kind enough to agree. So I have with us Roland. Hi, Roland. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. How are you?
I am doing very well too. Really excited to have you with us. I wanted to start out our conversation by asking you about how you got into ArcUnit. Like, what was there a specific problem that you were trying to solve, and you went, okay, let's explore what are the options available, and you landed on ArcUnit, or did you look at ArcUnit and try to see, where it would fit? Like, can you talk about your journey of how you discovered ArcUnit?
That's a good question, actually, because the first, I think I discovered ArcUnit after the first beta release, maybe. That is maybe 7, 8 years ago. And I think I found it somewhere on Twitter or GitHub or somewhere. And I thought, this looks like simple framework to first, to test your Java architecture, but also to query your Java code like you would use the Java Reflection API. And the idea to query your Java code with an API that is basically like the Java Reflection API was, wow, that's cool. And I'm not really sure if I need it right now to test my Java code, but it came. Always to, it came always again over several years, and I started to integrate it in nearly every project I used. And
Interesting.
it's still fascinating me that you can, analyze your Java code with a simple Java library.
So you've been using this for like 7 years, which is quite a lot.
From time to time, I'm not really sure if it's really 7 years old, but the beta phase from 0.4 and 0.5 and so on was really long. And I think just last year in summer, they released the first 1.0.0 release. So they are finally at the point where they say, this is how it should work and how you should work with it.
Okay. Have you had any experience working on ArcUnit, or are you primarily like a user of it?
I'm primarily a user of ArcUnit, but I also contributed some changes or enhancement to that. For example, that you can query the new Java records with ArcUnit that came with Java 14, I think, and some small enhancements and bug fixes. But
Interesting.
most of the time, I'm ArcUnit user and I like to talk and share about ArcUnit, but to show other people how great this library actually is.
Okay, I think that's a good segue into looking at what ArcUnit is. Like, and folks in the audience are probably interested. Like, what can it do? Again, testing architecture seems like a very vague thing. So maybe we can start, like, if you could talk about what is ArcUnit and why would somebody want to consider using ArcUnit for their Java projects?
Firstly, ArcUnit itself defines itself as a small free Java library to unit test your architecture, like I said in my conference talk title. And the goal is, or does so by checking dependencies between code units like packages, classes, or methods, or simply two code units. And what we can test with ArcUnit, I want to show with a little demo. For that, I created a small example. For this example, I used the Spring Pet Clinic. For those who are not familiar with that, it's a simple example application to demonstrate how to use Spring Boot and how to build web applications with Spring Boot. And in this application, we have two distinct modules, the owner, the pet owner, and his pets, and the vet who works at this pet clinic. And when we open the package, we, for example, see that we have several controllers that accept the HTTP requests, and we have something that maybe look like JPA entities or repositories to interact with the database. So this looks like a typical layered architecture where we have the controller on top, and we go down to some business layer and down to the database. And the first thing is, when we see, we open the package and we see actually what is the controller. It looks like every class that ends with controller. And if we go deeper in this class, we see it's actually annotated with the controller annotation from Spring. And for example, to make these classes easy to discover, we can say all our controllers that are annotated with this annotation should also have a name that contains controller. And with ArcUnit, we can now define this in a simple unit test. It looks like, if you're familiar with JUnit, it looks a bit like a JUnit test, but instead it has an arc test annotation. And arc rule definition. Definition. Dot classes. And we simply start with an entry point in the API, which is called classes. And now I can say classes that are annotated with controller should have name ending with controller. This is basically our first ArcUnit test, what we can use. Query single classes and look if they are defined in the way we want them to be defined. And I can now use my IDE and say run the demo ArcUnit tests. And after a couple of milliseconds, it's a bit longer than I expected. It says we have a green test because all our controllers are well defined.
Okay. But so when you call classes, you're asking ArcUnit to get its own representation of all the classes in the project, and then you're asking it to kind of perform certain tests on the classes or the structure itself, right? So here it just happens to be a certain naming convention and an annotation. Okay.
So basically we define our rule with a kind of fluent API, as you saw. I just can hit dot and IntelliJ or Eclipse or whatever IDE you use suggests where to go next. For example, I can query names or annotations or types or whatever. As you see, the scroll bar gets longer and longer. So the Fluent API can guide us to define our architecture rules. And behind the scenes, we have ArcUnit, which analyzes all our classes and executes the rule we defined here against all these classes. this is basically how ArchUnit works.
Okay. The first reaction that I had when you were demoing this was, this seems more like a linting rule rather than an architecture rule. Because here what you're doing is you're saying, here are rules for my syntax and how things need to be, as opposed to architecture, which is more of like interconnection between different parts of your application. And that's where you gave the second demo, which was about having these different classes call each other. And to be honest, that was where the power of ArchUnit really struck me. It was like, okay, you can establish rules about what part of your code needs to be able to call or should not call what other parts of your code. And can you talk about, it's kind of like it's a spectrum, right? So this seems like a lint rule, which is localized to a certain point, which is not so much architecture, I would argue, as opposed to this other example, which is architecture. Do you agree?
Yeah, of course, because we can define a very broad range of architecture rules here, which are maybe just rules, maybe these are really about the architecture. But most of the time I use ArchUnit to validate the structure of the code itself. May it be the architecture, how different modules interact with, or just how these classes are really structured. To show your audience the second test you mentioned, I opened another class with some architecture tests that I prepared, and here I defined a rule to test the dependencies between several modules. For example, that I can say the owner and the vet, these two domain modules should not interact with each other. This I could define like classes that reside in a package called something.owner.something should not depend on classes reside in a package something.vet.something. And also the other way around, so that I can test how these packages or modules depend on each other, or that they do not depend on each other.
Interesting. So depend on classes here implies, you know, it should not have like a member variable which is of that type, or, you know, or it should not have any references to the class which is of that type. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So if I'm in the vet package, I should not call any code that's in the owner package. And if I do that, ArchUnit will fail and provides me a good error message. There in the vet repository, you are calling the constructor of the owner, for example.
And this is where things are going to be very different from the linting thing as well, right? Because if you take something like SonarQube, I don't know if you can do stuff like this. I don't. Do you have experience with SonarQube? You know, if this can be done.
Yeah, I used it in several projects, and I also saw a GitHub issue for ArchUnit to integrate into SonarQube. But I think these two tools are on a different level. From what I see is that SonarQube looks into our code to validate, for example, if we have proper null checks or something like that, or how a class is defined, that they have consistent naming, for example. But ArchUnit is meant to check dependencies between two code units, so it's one level above SonarQube, I would say.
Okay, so is it fair to say SonarQube is more localized and looking at a class on its own and reporting on it, whereas ArchUnit is kind of like looking at the whole project architecture and trying to identify dependencies and relationships and trying to establish rules for those?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Did you have any other demo plan? Because I have a few questions about kind of like the philosophy of ArchUnit itself. I want to get your thoughts behind it. Is there anything else that you wanted to share in terms of the code?
Let me see. For example, First, I mentioned the, well, in this test, we tested that the modules are depend on each other or do not depend on each other. So it's more like the domain modules.
Mm-hmm.
We can also test architectural patterns, like we have a layered architecture where we have the controller, we have the service layer, and we have the persistence layer. This is what this test basically does. For example, it says we have a layer, we have a layered architecture here. And this consists of three layers, the controller, the domain, and the persistence. And we can define how is the controller layer defined. Well, these are all classes that are annotated with controller, for example. Or we can say the domain, these are all classes that are assignable to Java data, Spring data repository. Mm. Or everything from the persistence layer is annotated with Jakarta persistence entity. And then we can say, or we can define how this layer may access each other. For example, the controller layer should not be accessed by our code because it gets invoked from the framework. The domain layer should only be accessed by the controller, but not from the persistence layer. And the persistence layer on the bottom may be accessed by all the layers above, so that we can have the layers from the access between the layers from top to bottom, but not the way up. And with this simple rule, we can test our whole application if the layered architecture is defined in our whole code base.
That's pretty cool. And I can imagine this doesn't have to be just for like the three-tier layers that we typically attribute the word layer to. You can essentially create any number of layers for subsets of your architecture. You can say, okay, this is a certain domain and I'm going to assign it to a certain layer. And you can reuse those layers as well, because it's kind of like a runtime entity here. So I can imagine having like a utility class which gets a layer and then uses it in multiple test files and go, okay, this is my X layer and these are the rules that it needs to have with Y layer and with A layer and B layer and so on, right? This is really powerful. Can you talk about what are some rules that you typically tend to add in your Java projects when you use something like ArcUnit? This itself is pretty useful, right? You don't want your controller methods, anything that's in your controller layer, to be accessed by your service layer or your repository layer. You need that one single direction of flow. Mm-hmm. But apart from this, like, what are some common rules that you see generally applying to your projects using ArcUnit?
If I put both of these tests back to the screen, from what I see, what I typically add to project is one of those two rules, either that I check the dependencies between modules or that I check the dependencies between layers. Because most of the project I saw is that at least some architectural separation is also done on the build management level. So if we have, for example, a Maven project, then sometimes these Maven modules are also built on domain-specific modules, and in one or in each module, I would test if these layers are correctly defined. Or what I also see sometimes is that the Maven modules are structured by layers, so that I have a layer with the controllers, and then I have a layer with all the domain logic, and then I have a layer with all the persistent logic. And in this case, I would test that all these domain-specific modules are dependent or not dependent on each other. This is something I typically start with.
Okay. What do you think about, like, when you... So the way I'm understanding this is, when you use the word architecture, you usually mean this kind of like interplay of different modules perhaps different microservices to farm an overall system, right? When you bring our QNet into the picture, you're not so much testing the interplay between different runtime entities. It is more of the architecture given one runtime entity, like given one microservice or given one code base, really, whether it could translate to, one or more runtime instances. Is that fair? Like you're not looking at it at like a whole system level. It is given a component of the system, which translates to a code base. This evaluates rules of architecture for that unit. Is that fair?
I think that's fair to say, yeah, that I only test one runtime of a, or one, yeah, one runtime of one service or something that runs in a single JVM, for example.
Okay. This brings up a related question, which is about microservices. Typically, a large enterprise Java application consists of multiple microservices, and they usually tend to have this architecture drift over time. I've noticed, like, one architect builds, okay, you have to leave these 10 microservices and you have these rules and all that stuff. But then, as different teams start working on it, these microservices start to drift apart. You can easily tell, okay, this team worked on this stuff, this team worked on this, so there are some differences here, and it tends to happen. So, but when I heard of Arcunet, it was like, hey, this is a great idea to kind of consolidate everything so that you have these rules which apply to all these microservices. But then I went, well, hang on. These rules also reside in those individual projects. So you have microservices A and B. Microservice A has certain ArcUnit roles. Microservice B has certain ArcUnit roles. So the same factors which lead to this drifting apart of these things might also apply to the ArcUnit tests. So first of all, I'm curious to know, what has your experience been with these disparate code projects that perhaps need the same architecture rules? And how do you see ArcUnit applied to a microservice architecture which have these multiple code bases or multiple projects?
Maybe on a conceptual level, I would first say the beauty of microservices is that each team or each service can have a different architecture so that you're not bound to global architecture rules. So every team is free to build each service in the way they want them to build them. But on the other side, it's rather straight, or it's rather okay to say all microservices should be built in the same way and should follow the same rules. And the challenge is to provide the same rules to all these services or projects. And ArcUnit has something built in that we can use. For this example, I opened another demo I created for a conference talk. What you can also do is to provide a dedicated library with all units or with all architecture rules. For example, I created here a library with common architecture rules for my demo project, and this contains some general coding rules like we don't want to use log4j, or we don't want to use standard streams like system out or E dot print stack trace or throw new runtime exception or something like that. Now, this is not part of the standard streams, but this could also be a common coding rule. And then I have, for example, rules how to use JPA, or I have rules how to build the service layer in my application or in all my services. And on the other way, on the other side, I have my service, which has an architecture test. And here I say, I have my architecture, and I want ArcUnit to execute all tests, all arc tests that are defined in my common library. If I go to this rule, I can have that I have a list of my coding rules and service rules and persistence rules and JPA rules. And ArcUnit then scans all these test classes and sees, there is this ArcTests in, and goes into this class and scans all ArcTests and goes deeper and deeper and deeper until it finds all Arc rules. And this is a way to provide a simple Java library, for example, as simple Maven project or Raven project, and provide this library to all other teams that they can use it in their services. And the only thing they have to do is create this single test class, and it has all rules that they need, or all rules that they should execute.
So this will essentially solve that problem. You define, perhaps the architect of an organization defines these rules in one place. And then whenever you spin up a new microservice, you kind of pull in those rules and test it. While still, like you said, at the same time, you have the flexibility of potentially having certain microservices deviate from the rules, because that's the benefit, if you will, of microservices after all. On a related topic, the other question that I had was about who writes the stuff, because, you know, usually you look at like a junior developer who's only concerned with just getting the thing to work, and they have to follow these rules will be set by possibly senior developers or architects. So in your experience, have you seen like the architects define those rules and constantly maintain those rules, and then these projects pull in the rules and then apply it, so that whenever like other developers or perhaps somebody who is not aware of those rules break them, it kind of catches it right away so that it doesn't leak into the code base? Like, how do you see people working on these rules versus applying those rules?
Most of the time, the ownership, I think, for these architecture rules should be for the complete teams. So they maintain the rules for themselves. And what I see is that there's always that one guy that cares actually about the architecture, and this is the guy or the one who writes and maintains these architecture rules. And most of the time, I am that guy in the project.
Nice. I hope you don't get a lot of hate for it, because, you know, test breaking is always a painful process for developers. It's like, yeah, I got the code working, but still my test fails because of some rules. It can potentially be painful, but it's for the greater good, as they say. Yeah. Another question that I had was about these, you know, if I think back to my experience, maybe 10 years back, people are a lot more serious about architecture, I think, than they are today. There used to be this big formal process of like, you got to make everything right because code bases tend to live for a long time. And there was this, people were okay with that investment to architecture, to consistency and all that. But these days, there seems to be this trend of, okay, let's move fast. Let's not think too much about architecture. Let's build these small things and just get things working, and then we'll figure this out. There was this quote that you mentioned in your talk. I think it was from Wagner, or Bruckner, which is about, like, I have this here. Whoever wishes to build high towers must spend much time near the foundation, right? Which makes a lot of sense. And that was kind of like the motto of architecture and large Java applications 5 years back and 10 years back. But these days, what I notice is people aren't building large towers right away. People are building a lot of small towers, and it almost seems okay for them to not spend so much time on the foundations. Like, let's get these small towers working, and then after that, like, once we've proved out a concept or whatever, then we're going to build a larger tower. So I'm curious to see if you feel like ArcUnit seems more like a longer-term strategy than something that you start out doing. Like, when you start out, you don't want to think about architecture. I don't know if people even write unit is for their code. It's mostly just getting things to work. And once they have something there, then they bring in ArchUnit to establish longer term consistency. I just want to get your thoughts behind it. Do you see that as a trend, or do you see people getting into ArchUnit right away?
I also see that in projects that they start building something and maybe have rough architecture in mind. So, for example, we have these and these modules, and they should work with each other. And we have maybe Spring Boot on bottom, and we have a database, and let's get this to work. And when the application grows and the code base grows, then sometimes it happens that the code gets something of a mess, that we have like something like spaghetti code, but also they realize we need to get the structure back into the system. And this is the power of ArchUnit, I think, to show you the current architecture violations you have once you define the architecture rules you want to fulfill.
Okay. Do you see this happening in the developer flow, or is it more of a CI CD concern? Imagine you're working on the code base, right? Do you, let's say you finish some changes, do you run your ArchUnit tests before you post a PR? Like, what's the workflow for you?
Good question. Because the ArchUnit tests are like normal JUnit tests, for example. They are just part of the unit test suite, and maybe I execute them, and maybe the CI/CD environment executes them for me and punishes me with failing tests if I did something wrong.
Yeah, you wouldn't know related tests as well, because unlike unit tests, which is localized, with ArchUnit tests, you never know, right? You might make a change in your module which might break a rule which is somewhere else, right? There isn't like a one-to-one mapping between a piece of code and an ArchUnit test. So I guess you would have to run everything. So I guess CI is probably like a safer way to make sure everything runs. You might have to do your best effort in running it locally unless you want to run the whole thing.
But the beauty of ArchUnit is also that it can execute these ArchUnit tests really fast, because it has to analyze all the code base only once, and the execution of the tests itself is rather quick, like just like unit tests, in a couple of milliseconds. So actually it would be a good idea to execute it with all the other unit tests as well, because they are part of the unit test suite itself. So it really depends on the developer workflow.
Can you talk about onboarding ArchUnit to a project? Let's say somebody is, you know, some of our listeners are really interested in ArchUnit and they want to bring ArchUnit into a project. That can seem daunting, because, you know, anytime you bring in something like this, there are probably going to be like 100 violations on a decently sized Java project. So what would your recommendation be for somebody who is considering bringing in ArchUnit? Like, you know, do you have any advice or tips? Like, how would somebody go about doing that?
The good thing first is that adding ArchUnit to your codebase is just one additional dependency. For example, the ArchUnit core is one jar with maybe logging framework behind that, and that's all. But as you say, bringing it into an established code base might lead to hundreds of violations, because the code is not always structured like the rules say so. But ArchUnit is prepared for this, and therefore I have to share my screen again. And for example, let's say we define this architecture rule that we want that all our requests that modify our data should print some log messages, so that we can later see in the log file what was changed on which point of time. And so basically we want logging in our system is the most common architecture rule. And I defined here in my as ARCUNET rule, for example, methods that are annotated with post mapping. Again, an annotation from Spring. Everything that is a post request, for example, should log. But what logging means is, for example, we should call methods on the SLF4j logger class. In this case, we also see that if the ARCUNET API does not provide the rule you want to write, you can just write your own condition in this case. And if I go to some post mapping method, this one has 5 lines, and we can see there's no logging at all. So, and if I open the find again, we have 4 other mappings as well that also do not log. So adding this rule would lead to 5 violations, and to get this unit test green, we have to fix all those violations, which is for 5 methods, it's okay and to do in maybe 5 minutes. But if we have hundreds of violations which contain several broken dependencies, it will take you 5 weeks to fix all those dependencies, for example. And the idea is, ARCUNET brings a mechanism that is called freezing, that you can say, I freeze the current state of violations and say, I know these violations exist, but for the current time, I will just ignore these violations to let the test fail. If I execute these tests, I have the controller should log. Takes a moment. And the test is still green, but I don't have, but at least one method does not fulfill this rule. But what ARCUNET did, or what I prepared before, is that there is a list of frozen violations that is also committed with your code base in your Git repository, for example, that says, ah, we have several violations, for example, the method owner controller process creation form does not log. And when ARCUNET finds this violation, it does not fail the test, but it ignores this specific violation. When
Okay,
I
so a
add.
freeze takes in the same kind of validation that you would normally assert for, but instead of having a violation report as a red error, it instead says, okay, I'm kind of making a check and I'm kind of remembering what are all the violations, and it'll still result in green, but then it saves it to this file. So anytime you run it again, it checks if this violation was already recorded in the frozen file. If it is, then it'll not report it. But wouldn't that require you to remove the freeze? Because every time a freeze runs, isn't it updating this file?
For example, if I add a new violation to my code because I add a new post mapping method,
Okay.
let's say do something. This method does nothing, but is a post mapping method and it should log now. And I added new code to the code base and that's clearly violating our rule. Then we will see that the test fails with exactly one violation, namely the, where is, there it is. Namely the do something method does not log. So with the freezing mechanism, when we introduce it, we can freeze all the current violations that so that these tests so that these violations do not fail the test. But when we add a new violation to the code base, then these new violations will be reported.
Interesting. So how does freeze know? Is it the presence of the file? Like, for example, if I delete that frozen file and I run this again, it'll take this new introduced method as a previous violation, and then any new stuff from there on is going to get tracked. Is that how it works? The presence of the file?
Yeah, that the violation is present in this file, then it is ignored, basically. But this text file here with the frozen violations is more like a to-do list, so that you can go and see, the owner controller process creation form method currently has no logging. And when I introduce logging into this method, I can remove this line and commit the changes to Git. And from now on, this method would cause new violations if we have violations in there.
Right.
And
The
there it is
thing
again.
that I don't quite understand, Roland, is the last time freeze ran, it looked at all the existing violations and it saved it to file. That freeze line hasn't been removed from the code yet. It's still there and it's still executing. But this time, it doesn't look at all the existing violations in the code and write it to file. It's comparing what is in the frozen file with the present violations. So my question is this influenced by the presence of this file? The last time the freeze ran, this file didn't exist. So it created the file and then it recorded all the violations. The second time it ran, since the file exists, it doesn't record all violations, it's comparing. Is that right? Is my understanding right?
Yeah, that's correct. On the first
Okay.
run, when you introduce the freezing, Arch Unit checks if the file exists, and if not, it will create the file with all current violations. And on each run after that, it will see, the file exists, so these are the frozen rules, and everything else should lead to a violation, yeah.
Arch Unit to a project and there are like a gazillion violations, right?
Yeah.
You can freeze it and then try and prevent new violations from coming up while at the same time, like you said, this becomes a to-do list, right? You can gradually solve for it. A follow-up question I had about freezes, once somebody has frozen the violations, is there a need for the freeze word to be there, or can they just remove it because the violations already exist in the text file?
From what I know is that the freeze in the Java code, you need that this freezing mechanism works and that it compares with the text file. But once you solved all these violations, then you could remove the freezing itself from the code base in the rules. But it has, I
Okay.
think it has to be present so that it checks the text file and the violations.
Gotcha. All right. Cool. But while you were showing your code, I had one follow-up question that I know some from my audience would be interested in it. There was this complexity thing, not related to Arch Unit, but if you don't mind, could you share, is there like a plugin that you use to check the complexity?
The complexity.
Is the method complexity that shows up in IntelliJ?
Let's see if we can have it somewhere. Here, this
All
one.
right, there it is. Complexity 6. Can you talk about what plugin you use for that and how you use it?
Let me see. It is. I think it's the code metrics plugin, which basically
Oh.
computes the complexity of a method and of a whole class. For example, if you have an if statement, then you have two paths through this method for one if the if is true and one if the if is false. So it's basically two ways through the method. And if you have a
Cool.
complex condition like A and B, then you have more ways through the code and the code gets more complex. And these plugins just show how complex the actual method or class itself is.
Do you ever do anything with it? Like it says complexity is 6, it's time to do something. Have you ever had that motivate you to do something, or is it more like an FYI kind of a thing?
I actually installed this plugin maybe 2 weeks ago or so, and
Okay.
when it says it's time to do something on the class level, it's really strange. But if it's on a method level and it says there is a complexity of 14, then I'm currently working on that method. I try to find a way to make this less complex
That's fair. That's
and
fair.
more understandable.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your experience, what you do currently, and what are you passionate about as a Java developer? Kind of more of we're moving away from ArchUnit to trying to understand a little bit more about Roland as a Java developer. Like, can you tell me a little bit about your background and what you do?
I'm currently working as freelance software developer. So I'm going from developer team to developer team and helping making or bringing their legacy Java systems into the future. That's basically what I do. And most of the time it's structuring code and untangling or removing the complexity, like with the complexity plugin. Or remove all the spaghetti code that is building hard to understand code, but also introducing test automation or unit tests to a code base. Because sometimes the code is rather hard to understand and not so well documented, and unit tests, maybe there's someone who wrote some tests, but projects I see that are they are not so well structured as you would think. And these are some of the tasks I regularly do as freelance Java developer.
With that in mind, I can see how ArchUnit would be really useful for you. Like, you can kind of set up guardrails so that the complexity doesn't increase, and as people work on it, you can continue to reduce the complexity and enforce more rules. Can you tell me about what you mean by moving legacy code to the future? Like, how would you define future in this case?
Basically, what I'm trying to do is make the code understandable and maintainable for the rest of the developers and future developers of the project. By, yeah, understandable and maintainable, because when I open a random class and go into a random method that is long and long and long, it's quite hard for me as someone who does not know the code base what's really going on. And I can imagine it's the same experience for other developers, and especially for junior developers who start in the project. And yeah, that's one of my main goals, to rework or work on the code base to make it more maintainable and easy to understand. And also to say, this code is so obvious that there are obviously no bugs in it. So it also involves writing tests to show that it really works like it should.
Can I ask you something about freelancing itself? You tell me if you don't want to answer this, but I have always been in like a salaried 9-to-5 job. Like, I've never done freelancing, and the prospect of freelancing has always scared me because I quite like the security of a regular paycheck. I'm curious to know if you've tried like a salaried position or a full-time position, and compared to freelancing, what do you think are the pros and cons? I'm guessing you prefer freelancing because that's what you're doing right now. I'd love to get your thoughts behind like comparing those two, especially if you've done like a full-time role before.
Before I started freelancing 2 years ago, I was also in a 9-to-5 job as full-time developer, and that for more than 10 years in the same team. So
Wow, okay.
that's not quite common these days, I think. And the benefit of being a freelancer is that you can see different teams on different projects and different technologies, so that you can learn something new every day, I think. It's also with regular salary jobs, but there you have mostly always the same project and you build on top of that new features or fix bugs and maintain your project. But the cool thing about being a freelancer is that you can go from project to project and see different things. And that was one of the main reasons I switched my role.
I think the maximum learning you do is when you start working on a new project, right? Like the first month or so is where your learning peaks. And then after that, you do tend to learn, but not so much. So it kind of gradually, the curve gradually flattens. What do you think are the drawbacks? Because for me, honestly, I quite like the security of having like a regular job. And the thing that worries me with freelancing is like, okay, I have to keep finding the next gig. And this is true for contract work as well. It's like, I have to find the next gig and I don't know where it's going to come. And there might be portions of time where I'm just searching and I don't have anything to work on. Do you feel that, or is it not a concern for you?
Yeah. Finding the next project to work on is, I think, it's the biggest challenge being a freelancer. But the beauty on the Java ecosystem is that there are so many Java projects there that looking for Java developers, so running out of projects is not so risky in this case. But I'm especially looking into projects that do not build the next new big thing, but maintaining legacy projects, which is quite a bit harder to find projects for.
Right.
But yeah,
there should be a lot of those though, right? Yeah, legacy projects are probably more in number than building the next big thing. So especially when you say you're somebody who can clean up a lot of old stuff, people would probably welcome you because that's like a hard thing to do anyway, right?
Most of the time I work in projects, I do not add so much code, but I delete very much code.
Yeah. Removal of code is underrated.
I think the most productive days are those where I delete 1,000 lines of Java code.
Yeah.
Because they are too complex and are not needed anymore.
What are some other tools you use or other frameworks or libraries you use like ArcUnit, which makes it easy? Again, deleting code in a large legacy project can be a scary prospect because often it's like, you know, at best, nothing changes, right? You're not affecting any functionality. And at worst, you've broken something significant. So people tend to go like, okay, why not risk it? Let's leave it there. You don't know what will break if you delete something. So I'm curious to know your process. How do you go about deleting code? Like, do you have tools like ArcUnit, which kind of helps you? Or is it more like, do you have a process behind it?
It's basically just the features of IntelliJ that I use. So the IDE that I use from day to day, and it shows hints, this code is unused, you can delete it. And if you safe delete something, then it checks, is this method used somewhere else? And it says, oh, it's not safe to delete the method. And yeah, and IntelliJ is really good in supporting my life as I'm working on legacy code. And I'm not getting paid by IntelliJ for saying that.
All right. How about when you have multiple code bases, though? IntelliJ is useful when you're working on, I'm guessing legacy code would probably imply monolithic code bases most of the time, right? Because they wouldn't have modernized it to microservices. Do you see that as the common thing you work on? Like, what if you have, I think for all the drawbacks of a monolith, the call patterns are navigable, like you said, with IntelliJ. Whereas with microservices, it's hard to tell, like who is calling what, when is something being used. So do you find your work being more in the former category where, you know, IntelliJ can potentially help you as opposed to certain modern systems where it cannot?
because most of the time I'm working in such monolithic projects where everything is connected by Java API calls, so it's rather easy to use the IDE to navigate through all these call hierarchy stacks.
Interesting. I have so many questions though. This wasn't what I'd planned to ask, but the fact that you're working on modernizing legacy systems is very interesting because I don't know, we as Java developers get a bad rap for being slow in terms of adopting new technologies, very conservative in terms of modernizing our stack. So you're doing something which people wouldn't normally consider as glamorous work, but it is work that needs to be done, and it's very important as well. You're kind of paving the way for more glamorous work to be done. On a related question, how do you see the usages of newer versions of Java? Is that a part of your modernization strategy? I keep hearing a lot of people getting stuck in the older versions of Java, like there are a lot of Java 8 users still. What has your experience been with Java versions?
I'm currently in a project where we moved from Java 8 to Java 11 end of last year. And I saw another project where they moved this year from Java 11 to Java 17. So there's a broad range from using Java 8. And I have also a project where I'm stuck to Java 8 because of the runtime environment, up to newer Java versions. So we have a really broad range, and I would like to use the new Java features more often.
How about modules though? Is module like if you somebody has moved past Java 9, have people started using modules so much? It didn't get a lot of good reception initially. Like people were interested in the other features, but they didn't really weren't that excited about modularity. What has your experience been so far?
I've never seen the Java module system in a real-life project so far. But I think the main goal for the Java module system was to modularize the JDK itself, and as a side effect, that you can also use it for your own application. But using build tools like Maven or Gradle is normally enough in your Java projects, I would say.
All right. This is very interesting. I'm actually excited to try out ArcUnit in some of my projects and see what value I can generate from it. Do you have any recommendations for any typical rules that people tend to use? Like, is there like a library of some things that you can adopt, or is it more like each project, you figure out based on what you need?
That's a typical question after my ArcUnit talks. Is there a common set of rules that I can start using? ArcUnit itself provides very general rules itself. For example, the layered architecture I showed in the beginning, but also these general coding rules like do not use system.out.println or e.print stack trace, for example. This are some very general rules that are predefined, and there are libraries with predefined rules. The one is the jmolecules project, which has the goal that you can provide or that you can define architectural concepts directly in your productive code, not in the test code, but in the productive code, that you can say the package. Org example, service is part of the service layer, so that you can annotate the Java package with the annotation service layer. And jmolecules then provides ArcUnit rules to check if the layers are correctly defined so that the persistence layer does not call the service layer. So that you have the documentation aspect as well in your productive code. This is also a set of predefined libraries.
That's interesting. I'm not sure how I feel about that because, on the one hand, yes, it provides documentation, but on the other hand, I don't want that to be a point of failure. Like, if somebody forgets to add, that layer to the code, the test is never going to catch it. So I quite like the idea of the rule being defined separate from the code. So, you know, even if somebody were to make a mistake in terms of adding the right annotation, you can still infer it from like package rules or something like that. But it's interesting that it's there, so that at least as like, you know, where it works, documentation would be a good idea. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So I think in terms of rules, you would say look at the J molecule library to identify some common rules. Okay.
And beside that, I think every project is different, and so should, and each project should have arch unit rules or architecture rules that fit the application itself that you're working on.
I think we are at the end of our talk. Thank you so much, Roland, for spending your time with us and walking us through ArchUnit and also talking about
And
your experiences in general.
thank you for inviting me.
I'd love to have you again. And yeah, thank you. I hope you have a good day.
You too. Thank you.